on August 17th. Okay, we were talking about the Klan, and you were talking about some black loggers who came up from the south to Walla County.
What was the state they came from? Same. Clinton.
Arkansas.
Oh, yeah. Arkansas. Yeah. Most of them came from Arkansas, I believe.
Okay, you got acquainted with them after they had gone to work in Wallowa County, and then they were over here in Union.
Well, they moved back and forth. They worked in Wallowa County, and then sometimes, like anybody else, they'll come over here for shopping or for services, maybe a doctor's appointment or to come to see me or something, see? Yeah, they are, and then one of them was several of them became permanent residents of LeGrand. One of them was Lafayette Trice, T-R-I-C-E, the one we call Lucky Trice.
Okay, you mentioned him before.
I did.
What do you remember about him?
He loved to hunt and fish. And he was not inclined to harbor unpleasant thoughts about other people. He was a decent man. Now, he would tell the truth about some of the people that were in the Klan, because he knew about that. And he told me once that he had acquired a list of some sort of a document that had information about the Klan, and I don't know what it was. It may have been this little book here. It may have been something else, but he told me that.
What kind of work did you do with Mr. Trice? Did you represent him? And
you know, I don't recall ever representing him, but I don't think he needed a lawyer. What he needed was a deck, a poker deck. And that's what he did. He was a gambler part of the time, and a very good one. And he got along just fine with the people he played with.
Who did he play with?
All kinds of people.
And this was mixed black and white?
Oh, mostly white, I would say.
Okay. And this was about what time? What?
Oh.
In the 40s?
Yeah.
Okay.
That'll do. I was gone in 44 to 46, though. I wasn't here.
Okay. But you knew other people in the black community as a lawyer.
What was that question?
You knew other people in the black community as a lawyer.
Well, they came to my office for tax problems. I don't remember any other legal services that they needed from me or my wife.
Klansmen needed their robes made.
Very simple, short and simple. They wanted to wear these white gowns, you know, and the peaked caps, white.
Mm-hmm.
They had to have a tailor to make them. The only tailor in town was a Jew. I love that.
So what did they do?
I think they squirmed and went ahead and did what they thought they could get away with.
Okay, one of the things I remember from the book is that they were trying to affect the moral outlook of people, and they were against gambling and prostitution. What effect did they have on like your friend Lucky.
They were all gone by that time.
Did you
hear?
Yeah,
I came here in 39. They were all.
Yeah.
It was all gone by that time.
Do you know of any effect they had on the morals of the people in Le Grand, from what the stories you heard?
Well, they certainly didn't elevate the morals, because morals have to do with decency, conscience, fair treatment of others, and they certainly went the wrong road there. No question about it.
Do you know what other effects they may have had politically, either in the state?
Yes, I do.
Or locally?
They tried their best to get a law passed, and they were successful in making it possible or impossible for the Catholic Church to operate parochial schools for grade school kids, we'll say. They gave it their best, and they were successful. But that's not the end of the story. It was later found by the Supreme Court to be unconstitutional.
Was that law out of effect by the time you came here?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I don't remember when it happened. I haven't read the decision, but I know from reading wherever I read it that the thing. Oh, it's in this here. It's in this here. With that and this. This is the best, basically, written record and comment on the situation then and now.
The paper Charlie's talking about is a study on the relationship of Walter Pierce, who had been governor with the Klan group in Le Grand. He attended some meetings. It appears to be a political decision on his part.
Well, he does what politicians usually do. They accept whatever help they can get. Sometimes they have to damage their own system of what's right and wrong to do it, but they will do it anyway, and it happens in every place where there's a vote or an election. It happened here. I think Walter gave them encouragement, and I think he was supported their idea about the school bill. It mentions it here. He supported the school bill, which was, it says here, a high priority for the Klan. It was their way of undercutting the Catholics. Take away the school kids and you cut off part of the thing that makes them different from the other people.
Did you ever meet Walter Pierce?
Yes, I did. When I was a tiny child, I went to a picnic with my parents somewhere in Western Oregon a long, long time ago, and he was there.
But you didn't meet him in Le Grand or...
No.
I asked Charlie about what he knows about a Chinatown in Le Grand.
I don't know much about that, but I will tell you about a dark, dark chapter in the northwestern part of Oregon. And it has to do with a number of Chinese people they referred to in most stories as miners, and they were working the gravels in the Snake River. You don't know about this. You never heard this, did you?
No.
There was prejudice against the Chinese here, and there was prejudice in Wallowa County. There were a number of these Chinese down there working the gravels in the Snake River for gold. And some rather cruel and narrow-minded and prejudiced people with rifles got up on the ridges and rocks above where the Chinese were working and shot a lot of them in cold blood. It is part of the history of Wallowa County, and there are things, or were things, in the records of Wallowa County that told something about this situation. The authorities were probably as equally prejudiced against the Chinese as the run-of-the-mill loggers and lumbermen and other people in Wallowa County. And those people that killed the Chinese there in their diggings were never punished.
Were some of these Chinese also living in Union County?
That I don't know. I don't think so. Because there were some here, because they had, in excavating, they've dug up things that they are able to identify as things that the Chinese group had here, right here. But they're gone, they have been for a long, long time.
Do you know what kind of work they did here? The Chinese.
I have
in
no
Union
idea.
County. The millering we were talking about is listed as a Carl Millering.
Well, let's see what we can find here.
You know him as Singh Millering. S-I-N-G.
Yeah, well, that was the nickname of one of the Millerings. But
he was the one involved with the Klan. High up in the Klan.
Well, I don't say high, but I think Singh had something to do with it because of his employer, Mr. Bunting. I think he wanted him to be active in it as well as he could.
What other groups do you think the Klan targeted, and particularly with your knowledge of the people like Cochran, who you knew later on, what groups did they dislike? We have Catholics and blacks and Jews. How about
foreigners? Any kind of a outlander that came from someplace else. He wasn't welcome here.
What were those groups? Like you've mentioned Basques.
I would guess to mind their own business and not in any way, as far as I know, become involved with these kind of people. They wouldn't be willing to do that. They had no problems without that. And they have formed a significant part of our society. In Oregon, the best. There was one of them that was the head man in one of the big Oregon banks in Portland. Right now, I don't recall his name, but he certainly was a Basque, and he certainly was a real banker, real gung-ho type. Perhaps that is something they bring with them.
Do you know Bass in Union County and what kind of work they did?
Well, yes. All right. Where's my phone book?
Okay, you don't remember the names, but you do remember several Bass in the community.
Oh, yes, sure. They were.
How did you know them?
Well, they were part of the society, and I don't recall any serious work that I did for them, but I just don't know that a clan would be opposed to the Bass.
They weren't opposed to them.
I think they would be, but that's guessing. No, that's not a good thing.
You don't know it directly?
No.
Or from comments from people you knew?
No. It's an odd thing, but the best people that came here melted right into the society. Although I have mentioned about the fences they made around their corrals, which were much different than the barbed wire people.
Could you describe those fences again?
Well, they were just, they were interwoven branches of brush that grew right there where they were working.
They had some of these in Union County?
I have never seen any in Union County. That doesn't mean they're not here.
Other ranchers were using barbed wire at this time?
Yes. The barbed wire changed the whole economy of the West. Not only here, but everywhere, especially in what used to be early on the open range. With the advent of barbed wire, there was no more open range. Period.
Did you legally ever get involved with open and closed range disputes?
No.
You didn't? Okay.
No, never.
Okay, this is a Basque who settled in Union County?
Well, he had a sheep operation up the river.
What was his name again?
Tony Vey, V-E-W-V-E-Y.
Okay.
V-E-Y, Vey. And then there was the January family, Bass, from across the hill. Their headquarters were over there in Umatilla County. And the Irish tended to gravitate toward sheep, too, as well as the Scotch. And by the way, the herders, especially the Scotch and English herders, sheep herders, were some of the most intelligent and well-informed people that you'd be inclined to meet anywhere. Now, the reason for that was they had to spend so much time alone that they spent it reading and thinking. And being neighborly with people that come by One time I was working in a case in Umatilla County in Pendleton, and I had to come back at the end of the session, and it was dark. I had to come back in the night. And I was coming down this grade over here, just out of La Grande, of 2-3 miles, 4 miles. And I saw something moving across the road in front of me. So that kind of put the brakes on, you know, and I did. And I stopped, and it turned out they were sheep, and they had got loose from where the herder had them corralled or controlled. So I pulled off the road and looked around, and off of the road a ways I saw a tent. And so I went over there, and the sheep herder was there, and he was asleep, and I woke him up and told him that his sheep were wandering around in the road. So he got up and got his dogs and controlled the sheep, and then he invited me to have coffee with him. Now coffee, you know, sheep herder. Sheep herder coffee is something else, I will tell you, because the way they make it, some of them, not all of them, they will put grounds in the water and let it settle and stir it up and pour the water, coffee off, and leave the grounds in the pot, and then put some more water on the grounds. That's sheep herder coffee, believe me. I don't say that they all did that, but some of them did, and it's well known, and people will comment about sheep herder coffee. So that was, I had an opportunity to see quite a few of those herders during the trial we had about the boiling thing. And they are interesting.
This was the trial in Pendleton.
No, here.
Here in La Grande.
There was one there too. But that was a federal district court, had to do with a violation, as the government thought, that Tom and some of the others had broken the rules having to do with mortgaged property. You see, the thing is that the Oregon prosecutor, a man named Dillard, by the way, his name was D-I-L-L-A-R-D, he just didn't understand the sheep business, and it didn't take a country boy like me very long to understand the sheep business, because they come here in the mountains, and they take their flocks up in the mountains, and they feed them all summer, and they bring them back, and then they have to separate the lambs from the ewes. In the meantime, they have made contracts for the sale of their excess sheep, lambs mostly. And not only that, they have arranged to pay off the liens, mortgage liens, because they mortgage these sheep. So it is inevitable that sheep are going to be sold. They have to be. You can't keep a whole bunch of sheep the rest of your life. So they sell off the lambs and take the ewes and the bucks and go over to Butter Creek and the sand, and they spend the winter there. then the next spring they lamb out again, and then they come back to the mountains. Now they don't do that anymore. It's kind of too bad.
Okay, the question I asked Charlie is what he knows about newspaper publishing in LeGrand. He did know Bob Moody quite well.
Well, I don't know everything there is to know about it. I've already told you some that I thought, and I still think, that the power company acquired the ownership of the newspaper and used it to present their contentions having to do with the People's Utility District, and they also slandered me and a few other people. And but that's all gone, it's all past, and we've had some very good publishers since then, and one of them is mentioned in one of them is Robert Moody.
Okay.
He was a publisher there for a number of years of the Observer.
Who was the publisher you said slandered you, and how did he slander you?
A man named Fred Weybrot. He was the owner. I don't know who was actually operating the paper. And I don't remember the details and the way he slandered me, but it was a statement that I had been guilty of some serious thing before I got here. Well, if I was guilty of anything, it was going to school. That's all I did till I got here. And when I got through school, I came here. But I want to talk a little bit about one of the editors that operated the Observer in the latter years and in the latter part of my professional life as a lawyer. He was a Jewish boy, a Jew boy from Ohio, I believe, where my wife came from. His name was Eisler, Gary Eisler.
You know how to spell his last name?
Yes, I do. E-I-S-L-E-R.
Okay.
It is the way Eisler is spelled. I knew another Eisler. He was a doctor from Chicago, where you come from. One of the best surgeons I ever had to treat me, Dr. Eisler. Well, anyway, Gary Eisler was the head man here in the paper, and he was very active, and he did a good job. And finally, he left and went down to Portland, and later he died. Too bad. When he came from Ohio, he had some of the prejudices that people have from the East about firearms. Now, my life has been so closely associated with firearms all my life until I got old enough so I couldn't do it anymore. So I took Gary out with me to the rifle range, and I took along several firearms, and we shot those things at targets and so forth. And it turned out, to my amazement, that Gary Eisler was a natural at shooting, and he did very well in comparison to me, who had years of experience. So after the end of that, he acquired his own weapons after that, and I think I went out with him and we tried them out too. And that was about the end of that. And then 2 or 3 years later, He left here and went to Portland and finally died down there within the last 3 years.
Okay. Do you know any of the other publishers or editors or what their and what their effect on the community has been?
No, I don't. There was one editor by the name of Frank Shiro, S-H-I-R-O, that operated the thing, the newspaper, or helped run the newspaper during the squabble here about the People's Utility District. We're having a somewhat similar in Portland right now. I read about it in the paper.
Mm-hmm.
If you read papers, you know too. And you do read the papers, don't you? So did Jack Kennedy.
You're talking about President Kennedy? Okay. The question is about Charlie's history. He's won some awards for his shooting, and he's been involved with the National Rifle Association much of his life.
As I said, it's hard to say that contrary to the way that most professional starters do, they join as many different organizations as they can in order, they believe, to assist them in getting a start in a new community or to build a practice, medical or legal or whatever. But I didn't quite do that. I joined a local rifle club and the National Rifle Association, and I'm still a life member of the National Rifle Association, and I am a member of every single local shotgun club in the valley here. Well, anyway, a short time after I got here in 39, the Japanese made a terrible mistake at Pearl Harbor. And the first thing you know, we're involved head over heels in a war. Well, it occurred to the people that I associated with, young men and older men and people that thought that the defense of our country required their assistance, and I thought the same thing. So we got together and we practiced the things that we could practice at, which in shooting and the use and the handling of firearms. One of them was a man named Morgan. He was the county engineer at the time.
What's his first name?
I don't know his first name. I don't know, but his last name was Morgan, M-O-R-G-A-N. And he had military experience, and he used that to help us learn the things that he was thought that we should learn and that I thought we should learn. And it turned out rather well. As I continued to shoot every time I could do it. And then finally, Uncle Sam in 1944 sent me a letter and said, "You, boy, are needed." Well, at that time, I had just got started here, and I thought of myself as a lawyer. During my experience at Willamette University, I had studied French and German in what I fondly thought of as preparation to study in Europe. How in the heaven's name I was ever going to get to Europe, I had the foggiest notion. I did never get to Europe. But I did study everything I could in preparation. But when they asked me the things that they asked me when they were inducting me into the military, I did not tell them anything about the fact that I was a lawyer, that I had studied French, and I had studied German. I didn't tell them a single thing about that. I did tell them one thing that I thought was important at that time. I told them that I was skillful with a rifle. And they didn't forget that. And I kept it. I kept reminding them. So they sent me down to Cap Fannin, Texas, and I became a part of the 66th Training Battalion and went through the training there. And at the end of the training, one of the things they did, and they always did it, I guess, they had a shooting match for the whole group of us. And we shot the rifles they had issued to us. And I don't mind saying that the one they issued me was the lousiest piece of junk I ever saw in my life. Before I could make it work, I had to practically work it over, and I knew how to do it. But anyway, I won that shooting match, and they gave me a trophy, and it's downstairs on the mantel by the fireplace, and all the junk that's piled up there because they're working on my house, you know.
What year was that?
That was between 44 and 46.
Okay.
And they took me in on the day, and they let me out on the day. In those 2 years, February 14th or something like that. Well, I learned a few things when I was in the military, and they thought that, another thing had happened all along the way. Near the end of my tour of duty there at Camp Fannin, Texas, I developed a tumor in the right breast, and I called it to the attention of the doctors there at the base. And boy, they got excited in a hurry, and they sent me right now down to Austin, Texas, and to a general hospital, and that's that's where I'm at. The other, only other man from Chicago, Dr. Eisner. He operated on me, did a wonderful job. But I was most impressed with something else he did. Not for me. I was in a ward, a rather large ward. And there were, all the beds were full of soldiers, and some of them in terrible shape. I don't know, I didn't find out, but they were there, and they were broken men. That's when I found out about Dr. Eiser. Now, he had a full complement of duties, you can be sure of that. In spite of the hard work that he did for those other fellows, I'm not talking about me. This ward had a complete, well-equipped kitchen with food, everything. He would come back. In the evening, on his own time, if there is such a thing, and he would cook things for those other fellows, not for me, for those fellows that needed it. Didn't forget that.
Did you know other men who returned from World War II here in Union County?
Yes, I do.
What was your acquaintance with them?
One of them was a friend of mine that I dealt with. He ran a service station in Baker. He lives here in La Crande now.
What was his name?
I'll tell you. I'm not through. Dallas Dean. Like Jimmy Dean. Dallas Dean. He lives here now. He's married to a young woman by the name of Charlene. And she was one of my clients years ago. But an odd thing happened, and I've told you part of it. When they sent me to Austin, to the General Hospital there, it interrupted what they had planned for people like me. And the plan was, it turned out that I was at the end of the training period. And I was gone when this time happened. I was in the hospital in Austin. When I came back, I don't remember seeing it, but evidently the people in my battalion had been moved out and taken to Europe, and some of them are still there. So when I got back here, one day down at Safeway, I was met by Charlene and her husband, Dallas, and I talked to him. And I asked him about one of the men that I had trained with. He didn't. He didn't make it back. He's buried in the Hurtgen Forest. That's the Battle of the Bulge. That's where they took my teammates, my soldier friend, when I was in Texas.
Do you know, you remember his name, the one who died in the Hurdgen Forest?
Sergeant Clausen.
Do you know his first name?
No. Sergeant Clausen. Got hit in the head with a cannonball from a German gun. But going back now, a very strange thing. Maybe you can explain it to me. I don't think anybody can. That I don't remember just when it was, but after I had demonstrated to the military authorities that I was competent with a rifle, you suppose they made a battle soldier out of me? No, they made a clerk. They gave me a job clerking in the battalion headquarters. And then they moved me to Fort Joseph T. Robinson in that state with a funny name. And I was there for a while, and I don't know what they had me doing. I don't know. I was there subject to whatever they needed. And one day, the commanding officer of that unit, of which I was a part, in the Camp Joseph T. Robinson, came to me, and he made the strangest request for me in the military. But this time I was sort of acquainted with the way the military operated. And the way it operates is the commander and those in charge give orders and people obey them. That isn't what happened with this commanding officer, not me. He asked me a question. He asked me if I'd be willing to take on the job of mess sergeant. He asked me. I didn't hesitate. I thought that was a good kind of job. I always liked to eat anyway. So I was mess sergeant for a while. And I did what I was supposed to do, and evidently I got it done all right, to the extent that my mess was so popular that the officers from the officers' mess started coming over and eating in my place. When the people in charge found that out, they made him quit it. Well, I had a cook. His name was Music, spelled just like music. He was a stockade prisoner. I have no idea how he got the stockade. I never asked. But every day they brought him over under guard to my mess. And then they left him, and he would do his thing. And he was a marvelous cook and a great person. I had two Russian Eskimos, natives, crossed with Russian in Alaska. Not uncommon. I had two of them. They never said anything, but they were good workers. And once in a while, I'd give them a bottle of beer, and that's all it took to make them happy.
This was in that other state, you meant Arkansas, I think.
Yes.
Were any of the other men from Union County there with you, or you were separated from them?
No. I don't know where they were, but I didn't even see Mr. Clinton in Arkansas.
Okay. What contact did you have after you got back from the war with other servicemen here in LeGrand and the county?
Really, none except Dallas Dean.
Just Dallas Dean.
Now, however, here about 2 or 3 years ago, they invited the veterans to come in and get shots for a virus. What is it?
A flu virus?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I was a whole bunch of us down there in the new building waiting and got shots, and that's it.
Did you remember any of them?
Well, they weren't with me, and I wasn't with them. The only one that I knew that, except the judge, Judge Brown was in the military at the same time I was, but he carried a law book rather than a gun. I carried a gun. For whatever it's worth. Then there was another man. His name was I can't think of it. Who was the district attorney after Mr. Helms? Well, anyway.
Do you remember Judge Brownton's first name?
Wesley.
Wesley Brownton.
Wesley Frederick Brown. He was a Methodist, and that's the way they do things.
Three names.
No. Wesley is the word, you know.
Yeah.
Was it Wesley?
That's a kind of an interesting thing. I think we touched on this last time, but you didn't have the recorder. Sometime along the way, after Judge Brown retired, we had another judge. He was a lawyer here for a while. His name was Wasley. W-A-S-L-E-Y. What was his first name?
Warner
Wesley. Now, this is one of the strangest things to me, because he was an acceptable judge. Nobody complained. Maybe he complained because he quit judging, he quit practicing law, and he's a farmer right over there, several miles over north.
Still in Union County?
Yep.
Okay, up by Somerville?
Could be. I don't know just where it is.
Okay.
Somewhere out there. Now, this is a little strange, it seemed to me, in spite of the experience that I had with my own father, because he was a successful salesman, businessman in Portland, and all of a sudden he quit it, and ever after, all he wanted to do was be a farmer, to the extent that if he couldn't acquire his own land, he would work, and did, as a hired hand on farms in Saskatchewan, Canada, in Tillamook, Oregon, around Forest Grove in Yamhill County. He worked there for a man who had a rather odd name. His last name was Smith, but his first name was Pliz. His Pliz Smith. My father worked for him. He, among other things, I think he had a few sheep too, by the way. Anyway, so Warner Wadsley preferred to be a farmer than a lawyer or a judge. He's not the only one. I mentioned my father. Same thing. Don't understand it. Never did. But there was a doctor here. What was his name? Clinic. Good.
Kelly Mutch?
Nope.
Leister?
Nope. Had a English or a North name. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. This doctor was a good doctor. People liked him. I liked him. I went to him once or twice for something or other, and he wasn't happy doctoring. He didn't show it, but he proved it. What he wanted to do was build buildings, and he quit doctoring and went to building buildings. That's what he did.
About what time was this?
That's about 15 years ago.
So maybe 1990?
Or maybe a little longer than that.
Okay.
I don't really know. He was a good man. We liked him. He was a good doctor. But he wanted to build things. And that's what he did.
Do you know any other interesting characters like this who switched careers or did one thing and then turned right around and did something else?
Well, I can tell you one thing. What I learned from my father, if I learned it at all, I'm not sure I did, but the result was, when I came here, I never left. I never tried to do anything else.
Other than the law. Okay. Let's get back to your hunting. Along with your expertise with a rifle, you hunted while you were here. Who did you hunt with?
One of my hunting partners was a man named Howard Peterson. He was of Danish extraction, so was my grandfather. And in the first 5 years that I hunted with Howard, he killed 8 elk, and not one of them had an antler on it. And then I got lucky. I hadn't fired a shot for 5 years. 5 years that I'd hunted with him. And then we went to a place east of Union, back in the roads and trails and things back in there. And we picked out a place, he picked out a place where he wanted to be, and I picked out a place where I would wait. The object is to wait for the animals. You may not know this, but that's one way to hunt elk and sometimes deer too. I was lucky. I'd been there a little while, and I remember it was cold, real cold. And I had a fire, and I was waiting, and I saw antlers coming through the trees, huge, beautiful, forked antlers. And he was coming to the opening right near me. He stepped out in the opening, and I attracted his attention with a little sound, a little noise, something like that, see? He stopped, and I put a ball right through his lungs, and he ran a little ways, and that was the first antlered bull that I killed. Next year, I was back there in exactly the same place, and it's a complicated story, but at any rate, another bull came over from the other side, and I killed him too. I killed two bulls right there in the same place, two separate years. From then on, I had good luck. And I've been thinking about it a little, and I couldn't sleep. Why was I? How did I do this? Well, it turned out that I had a kind of an aptitude for anticipating the places where elk would pass through. We're not talking about deer now, just elk. The elk is a greater trophy. It's a more important trophy. He's big, lots of steak thing. So anyway, it all ended up, and I think I killed at least 8 good bulls, and every one of them was because I had accidentally or otherwise picked out a place where the elk was going to be.
Who else did you hunt with?
And Clark Hyatt, who is retired now, but he used to work for Gosses. And he worked at first for years as the parts man. And then an interesting thing happened. One day, Mr. Goss came to Clark and he said, "Clark, how would you like to try your hand at selling cars?" And Clark said, "Why?" "I have no idea." But he says, "If you want me to, I'll try." And he did. And he was a good salesman. And he did very well. Very, very well. He was a great salesman. And he sold a number of cars to me.
Did you ever hunt with Lucky Trice?